Central Time, I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as the birth control pill turns 60 this month, we'll look at the impact it's had on the lives of American women and men. First, it's not a secret that Wisconsin is sharply divided politically. For example, take a look at the approval ratings for our elected officials in the most recent Marquette University Law School poll. Let's focus on what the opposing party thinks of each of them. President Trump has 5% support among Democrats. Republican Senator Ron Johnson has 12% support from Democrats. Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat, has 12% support from Republicans. But then there's Governor Evers. Among Republicans, he has 27% support. When it comes to his handling of the coronavirus, GOP support goes up to 35%. Our next guest did some analysis on why Evers is enjoying decent crossover support, at least by today's Wisconsin standards. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, good to have you back with us.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
Well, on the one hand, Craig, 27% support from the opposing party doesn't sound like a big number, but by the way things go lately, it's kind of a big deal. What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you go back and look at some of our past elections, you know, that when I was first covering state politics in Wisconsin, you know, Russ Feingold got elected to the U.S. Senate in the early 90s, and he got like 25% of the Republican vote. And Bob Caston, his Republican opponent, got like 25% of the Democratic vote. You can find examples even more dramatic than that with Tommy Thompson and Herb Kohl. But that kind of disappeared over the last decade and a half. And, you know, in today's era, it's very unusual for a major political figure nationally, but particularly in Wisconsin, to get any kind of support or even kind of positive ratings from voters in the other party. Tony Evers is proving to be somewhat of an exception to that. I think it's partly the current numbers are partly a reflection of the pandemic, but this pattern kind of preceded the pandemic. So I think it's also partly owing to perceptions of him and his background, and also the contrast between him and Governor Scott Walker, his Republican predecessor, who was, you know, obviously a very polarizing figure.
Yeah, I wanted to go there next. There are a lot of different ways to slice and dice this. Can you compare and contrast what we saw in surveys about Governor Walker versus what we see about Governor Evers?
Yeah, Governor Walker was a classic case where everybody had an opinion about him, so there were no don't knows. He was also a case where Republicans overwhelmingly liked him and Democrats overwhelmingly disliked him. He was also a case where he was right around 50-50 all the time. Sometimes he was below that number. Sometimes he was a little bit above. But his overall approval rating, partly because of how polarized people were over him, his overall approval rating never got higher than 52% in 50 polls that Marquette University did over the last seven years of his 8-year governorship. And finally, you know, if you ask people about their kind of intensity of opinion, they had really strong opinions about Governor Walker for good and for ill. You know, more than 2/3 of voters either strongly approved of him or strongly disapproved of him. So on all those dimensions, we see a difference with Tony Evers. I think that difference originally had to do with the fact that he wasn't nearly as well known. I think it's also had to do with the fact that he came out of a nonpartisan sort of background, you know, an educator. He was state school superintendent. He wasn't like a state legislator or a partisan political figure. And I think, you know, his style, he's a low-key, mild-mannered guy. He hasn't done a lot of unpopular things like Scott Walker did some very controversial things. But in the case of Governor Evers, he also hasn't had an opportunity to do a lot of controversial things, even though there's some controversy around his handling of the pandemic, because you have a Republican legislature that is basically going to block, you know, his agenda by and large.
Right. And that's a very big contrast to Scott Walker, who had a Republican majority from the get-go and could advance his agenda, including the bits that the other side really didn't like. And you talked to some political strategists who thought that alone might account for this difference in polling.
Yeah. And of course, you know, everybody remembers that Governor Walker, right out of the gate, you know, dropped a political bomb with Act 10, something that, contrary to what he has said, he didn't really campaign on. and was a surprise and a shock to voters and was obviously hugely unpopular with Democrats. It was, modestly popular with a lot of independent voters and very popular with the Republican voters, but it caused such a backlash on the Democratic side, and even that backlash was polarizing. Everybody remembers the drama around that, the protests, the recalls. So that happened right at the outset of his governorship, and it really kind of set the tone for public opinion and the divisions in public opinion over him for his two terms in office.
Talking to Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at polling of Governor Evers and how he compares to other political figures, Scott Walker when he was in office, President Trump, Senators Baldwin and Johnson. Governor Evers having higher approval and less polarized thoughts about him so far. We're looking at some of the reasons for that. You can join in, by the way, if you have a theory at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Craig, another point of comparison might be to other governors. What do you see when it comes to cross-party sentiment when you compare Governor Evers to some other governors in states where they do this kind of polling?
Well, there actually are governors who get more broad cross-party support than Governor Evers. And again, this may be partly owing to the fact that Wisconsin remains a very polarized state. The extreme example might be Governor DeWine, the Republican governor of Ohio, who's got like approval ratings, at least for his handling of coronavirus, in like the 80s, and you can't get an approval rating in the 80s without getting tons of favorable ratings, very high favorable ratings from voters in the other party. And there actually are a few Republican governors in purple and blue states that are getting higher ratings from voters in the other party on coronavirus than they're getting from voters in their own party, which is pretty remarkable. I would say the other pattern that's interesting is if you just look at, there's not a ton of great polling that allows us to compare governors' overall approval ratings across all these states, but there's a couple of organizations. One is sort of a group of, Harvard, Rutgers, and Northeastern universities have done 50 state polls on how governors have handled coronavirus. Also, another polling outfit in a study published by the Washington Post has done the same thing. And in both of those, even though Tony Evers has quite positive ratings on handling coronavirus, he's actually like in the bottom, quintile of governors. He's below average. Because other governors, almost all governors have gotten a boost for their handling of the pandemic, but a majority of governors are getting actually higher ratings than Tony Evers is in their own states amid this kind of rising tide for all governors.
Yeah, talk a little more about what we know from polls. And we've only had a couple of these so far because this is new. But what are polls telling us about what Wisconsinites think of Governor Evers' performance specifically on the coronavirus issue?
Yeah, I believe in the last two Marquette polls, we saw some really big numbers where his ratings on coronavirus, I think in the last poll, were in the 60s, maybe low to mid 60s. I think they were even in the high 60s in the March poll. A couple of things have happened. That March poll, which saw sort of his ratings really peak and really soar, it was before the issue of the pandemic began to kind of polarize public opinion along party lines. I mean, even today, it's not 50-50. Even today, there's a majority support for restrictions that governors have been pushing, for the stay-at-home orders, for social distancing. All of that has been kind of largely popular, but we've seen it become a little bit more divisive where the gap between Republicans and Democrats has grown. And so you get a kind of a larger minority, mostly of Republicans, really pushing back on the restrictions and wanting, kind of a more rapid shift toward a reopening. And so we have seen in national polling and in the Wisconsin polling, this issue become more divided along party lines. So Governor Evers in the last poll still had a really good rating on his handling of coronavirus, but, his numbers among Republican voters went down more than among independent voters and Democratic voters over this issue.
We're talking about Governor Evers' relatively strong approval ratings in usually polarized Wisconsin with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you approve or disapprove of the job the governor is doing? Do you see him as a less polarizing figure than some other figures in Wisconsin politics in recent years? Are you among the roughly quarter of Republicans who say you support Governor Evers? How do you generally feel about state politicians from across the aisle? And do you see Wisconsin as divided as we sometimes make it out to be? Or do you think, you know, we hear more from the extremes on both ends and there are more people in the middle than we know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about Governor Evers and how he performs in surveys in the state. The latest Marquette University Law School poll shows him with 59% support, including 27% of Republicans, which is a lot by Wisconsin standards for cross-party support. His numbers are stronger even for his handling of the coronavirus. Craig Gilbert is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the job Governor Evers is doing, both overall and on COVID-19? If you're a Republican, do you support Evers, or do you wish Scott Walker was still in charge? Do you find it hard to even consider supporting a politician in the opposite party, or have you, at some point in recent years, voted across the aisle from the way you usually vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig, before we get to our callers, let's talk about the independent voters. And sometimes we think those are people in the middle. Often they're independent on one side or another. What do we know about them and their support or lack of same for Governor Evers?
Yeah, so there's really two different groups of independent voters that we see in the polling in Wisconsin. One is like the pure independents, the people that, you know, you ask them, hey, what party do you identify with? And the people that don't say, you know, Republican or Democrat, they say independent. And then you ask them again, well, even though you're an independent, do you lean more toward one party or the other? And the people that still say they're an independent and don't lean is actually a pretty small group. It's like 10%. But the larger group of independents includes people that are like soft Republicans, soft Democrats. They're kind of Republican and Democratic leaning independents. And that we have better numbers on them because they're just a bigger group and the numbers are more reliable. So among that group, you know, he's got pretty positive ratings, which you would expect from somebody who's, you know, in the high 50s in terms of his approval overall. So he's doing well with this group. You know, the other little caveat I would add about the numbers he's getting from Republicans is, you know, even when he's getting 20 or 25% approval from Republicans, you know, you wouldn't expect those Republican voters to necessarily vote for him right in an election, because what happens around the election is everybody gets that much more polarized. In fact, there's an interesting wrinkle in Evers' ratings where his approval ratings are considerably higher among Republicans than the numbers he gets when the voters are asked if they view him favorably or not. That's more like typically been seen as like a more personal measure of your popularity. And so it's kind of odd that, you know, he might be getting 20 or 25% approval for his performance among Republicans, but maybe 10 or 15% favorable ratings from Republicans, which could just mean that, you know, the difference could just be that some Republican voters, that they don't really like him. He's a Democrat. They're not crazy about him, but they think he's done an okay job. I don't know whether that's the right interpretation, but it's a weird little wrinkle in his polling. We didn't see that at all with Scott Walker. I mean, his ratings, his favorability ratings were exactly the same as his approval ratings.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sherry is with us in Elkhorn. Sherry, hello.
Hi. I just want to say that I think Evers is doing the best job he can without having to fight off the Republicans at every decision. He's trying to do what's best for Wisconsin, and they're fighting him every which way. And I just don't think that's fair to judge him for his achievements because of that.
Sherry, thanks a lot for the call. And that touches on a little bit of what we were talking about earlier, Craig, since Governor Evers doesn't have the opportunity to full-on advance his agenda, given a Republican legislature, he maybe gets kind of an incomplete because people don't know what to make of him.
Yeah, I don't think he's getting penalized in the polling for what he hasn't accomplished. And so maybe that gets to what the caller was suggesting, that some voters, including some independent voters, may be saying, well, they may be accounting for the fact that, you know, understanding there's not a whole lot he can get done in divided government with a legislature that's not just Republican, but overwhelmingly Republican and obviously opposed to most of his ideas. The interesting question will be, you know, when we get to re-election time, you know, the situation with Scott Walker was his polarization around him was always a double-edged sword. It meant that, you know, he could always count on a very firm base of support, and he could always count on a very firm base of opposition. But his numbers, you know, were kind of resistant to change, and it also meant that, you know, it was hard, you know, in campaigns to really go after him because people had very firm opinions of him. So it was good and bad. The question with Evers will be, you know, if it turns out that his identity is not as firmly planted among voters, you know, that could leave him vulnerable to attacks because it could make it easier for the other side to sort of push public opinion against him. Or he could just turn out to be, you know, relatively popular with enough kind of quasi-independent voters that he'll be really advantaged in an election. We just don't know.
Thanks for that call, Sherry, at 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is with us, Washington Bureau Chief from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Governor Evers' approval ratings in the polls here in a usually polarized Wisconsin. Craig, I mean, we talk about Wisconsin being super polarized. We talk about the United States being pretty polarized. Do we have a sense of whether we really stand out here in Wisconsin with how divided we are compared to other states?
You know, I think most of the evidence over time that I've seen does suggest that, you know, even compared to the rest of the country, we're a little more polarized. I mean, if you think about it, I mentioned Ohio, which is a state that's been a battleground state. There's been a lot of political conflict and competition in Ohio. But when you see, you know, Mike DeWine, the Republican governor, with, you know, approval ratings from the other party as high as they are, and you see him up in the 70s or 80s or whatever, it's just really hard to imagine anybody in Wisconsin doing that. You know, even if they were a carbon copy of Mike DeWine, because we are that polarized, it just seems like, you know, support from one side just comes with a certain amount of automatic opposition from the other side. In the past, when I've looked at, you know, how polarized voters are over presidents from one state to another, there's been, you know, some evidence in the polling that they are, in fact, the more polarized in Wisconsin by party over national figures than voters in other states. This wasn't always the case. I mean, I mentioned, you know, people like Herb Kohl and Tommy Thompson, but I think in the modern era, in the contemporary era, it just seems like this state, for a variety of factors, has just been such a hotbed and such a hothouse of political conflict that, you know, you just can't imagine some of the kinds of levels of crossover support that some politicians have occasionally gotten in other states happening in Wisconsin.
Let's bring on another caller now. Robert is with us in Amherst Junction. Robert, hi.
Hi there.
You know, what do you want to bring up, Robert?
I'm seeing a familiar pattern I just wanted to put out there. Back in the Obama administration, the leader of the Senate and a number of other senators clearly, in fact, they even spoke about not wanting President Obama to have any wins. They pledged to be against everything he does, and they tried. They tried to push against everything he tried to do, even if it was good for the people of America. They didn't want him to have the win. And what I'm seeing now is Fitzgerald and Voss doing the same thing to Evers.
Robert, thanks for the call. Craig, is there any incentive to cooperate or, flipping around, any punishment for not cooperating for, say, Republican lawmakers with a Democratic governor?
Well, I mean, this gets – when you talk about the Republican lawmakers, you know, it gets back to the nature of their districts. And, of course, I mean, I think it's pretty known that – that, you know, Wisconsin has a tilted legislative map. I mean, I don't think there's much dispute about that. So that means that, you know, that's, you know, a byproduct of that is a legislature that's, you know, has a pretty overwhelming or pretty lopsided Republican majority. And that also means that large majorities of legislators, you know, represent districts that themselves are quite Republican. So you don't have like a lot of Republican legislators in 50-50 districts. That might have been true 20 years ago when the Republicans had legislative majorities. It's not true today. So, again, you don't have a lot of Republican legislators that have that kind of political incentive they would have from representing a lot of Democrats or even representing a very competitive district. We don't have that. So the incentives really aren't there. I mean, that's also true to a large extent of Congress, where most districts on both sides in the House of Representatives are pretty tilted in one direction or another. And that's, you know, both in Wisconsin and nationally, that's partly the product of, you know, political trends and political segregation and residential patterns and the fact that cities tend to be overwhelmingly Democratic and rural areas tend to be pretty strongly Republican. But on top of that, the way the districts are drawn has amplified that significantly, particularly in Wisconsin. So, you know, we may have to wait until the next map is drawn after the 2020 census and we get a new set of political districts. And if it's a map that's not just drawn by one party, then it could be, you know, we could see more districts that are competitive and we could see a larger group of legislators in Wisconsin that, you know, that are pulled in both directions. Now, the parties are pretty polarized anyway, so that's not necessarily an automatic answer. But you know, it's certainly one thing that's going on today that's, you know, driving some of this.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about Governor Evers' relatively high popularity in Wisconsin despite the state's deep partisan divide. Coming up after the news, the birth control pill turned 60 years old this month. We look at the past, present, and future of the pill and its impact on women in America. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers unveiled a new $25 million assistance plan for renters dealing with the economic fallout of the COVID-19 outbreak. We'll learn more about what's included in the initiative in just a bit. Now, 60 years ago this month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the birth control pill for prescriptions with the promise of giving women more control over childbearing. Just days before its anniversary, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case that could allow some employers to deny coverage of the pill based on moral or religious objections. Our next guest says the pill has been a major player in some of the most contentious issues of the last half of the 20th century and an important tool for women looking to achieve control over their lives. Elaine Tyler May teaches American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She looks at the intersection of gender, sexuality, race, culture, and politics in the U.S. during the 20th century. Her books include America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's look back at some of the earliest impacts of the pill. And you've written that, you know, people think of it affecting single women a lot. Actually, it had a bigger effect on married women initially. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, of course, married women were the ones who were having sex more than single. There were more married women, and they were the ones who were most at risk of having getting pregnant and having children. Certainly, single women were also at risk of having sex and becoming pregnant. But there were more married women, and at the time in the 1960s, the marriage age was quite young, and so young people were getting married at a greater rate, and obviously at risk of getting pregnant and having children right away. So it was really the family planning aspect of the birth control pill that promoted it initially by its most of its advocates that it would help couples delay and space their children so that they could have as many children as they wanted and be able to take care of them in terms of their own plans for their families.
You've written about the ways that the pill did and didn't live up to what its earliest supporters were hoping for. How much did it live up to that promise? How much did it change the lives of married women being able to plan when they got pregnant?
Well, the thing about the pill, it was revolutionary. It was revolutionary on three counts, really, in terms of a contraceptive device. And basically, if nothing else had changed, this is what the pill would have achieved. It separated the act of sexual intercourse from contraception. Up until that point, any kind of contraceptive or birth control methods required an interruption of the sex act, and the pill removed that. The second thing it did is it put contraception completely under the control of women. So their sex partner might not necessarily even know that they were taking the pill and wouldn't necessarily need to give their approval. So it put the control in the hands of women. And thirdly, the birth control pill was by far the most effective form of contraception that was available at the time. It was almost 100% effective if it was used properly and consistently. So that's what made the pill revolutionary as a contraceptive. Now, what made it revolutionary in terms of the lives of women was that it coincided with the beginnings of the feminist movement and opening up of workplaces for women. So if it hadn't been for that, the pill would have just been a much more effective birth control measure. But because it came along and was really given a lot more life and a lot is because it was a time when the women's movement was beginning to push open a lot of doors that had been closed to women. And what the pill did is it made it possible for increasing numbers of women to actually walk through those doors without fear of getting pregnant and having their hopes and dreams and aspirations curtailed by unwanted or inopportune timing of getting pregnant and having children.
I've heard the case made over the years that the pill happened and then that led to the sexual revolution. Is it that simple?
No. No, it's not that simple at all. First of all, the sexual revolution has a much longer history that predated the arrival of the pill. And second of all, as many of the proponents at the time were quick to respond to any reporters who asked that question, and this was the question of the day, isn't the pill going to contribute to what they called at the time sexual promiscuity? And that was a word that was only used in terms of women. Men were never sexually promiscuous, only women. Men might be sexually active, but it was never that pejorative term that was used to talk about particularly single women. And what people at the time said, and it was pretty much true, is that the pill in itself didn't really change people's sexual behavior. To some small extent, it may have helped single women who were sexually active to prevent pregnancy. But it wasn't like suddenly the pill was available and a whole bunch of single women who wanted to have sex would say, whoop-de-doo, there's a pill. Now I can take the pill and go off and have sex. It just didn't work that way. It was much more the way in which sexually active women, either single or married, made use of the pill to help them control the possibility of getting pregnant.
It's the 60th anniversary this month of the approval of the birth control pill for prescription here in the United States. Elaine Tyler-May is with us from the University of Minnesota. Her books include America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. Do you see ways in which the birth control pill didn't live up to the promise initially, Elaine?
Well, it did to a large extent because within just a few years, the vast majority, certainly of married women, they were using the pill. And the pill was very widely accepted and supported, even advocated by mainstream political and religious institutions in the country. almost every institutional religious organization supported the use of the pill. Even the Catholic Church came very close in the mid-1960s to approving the use of the pill for Catholic women. And even when the Catholic Church did not change its policy, within a few years of the approval of the pill, Catholic women were using the birth control pill at the same rate as non-Catholic women. And I think in many ways it did live up to its promise. Problems with the pill had to do with side effects that some women experienced that were either inconvenient or painful or dangerous. There weren't a lot of those, but there were enough to cause some alarm. And when the pill was first approved, it approved at a very high dose. And over time, research supported the effectiveness of lower dose pills. And so those did develop over time. And the fact that the pill really did require consistent use. And so if women who took the pill did not use it properly, did not use it consistently, they could still get pregnant, and many did. Overall, the pill was very successful in terms of what it was intended to do, but it didn't revolutionize people's behavior, other than in the sense that it really did revolutionize the ability, particularly for women, to control procreation. And in combination with the women's movement, it helped to open up a lot of opportunities for women. But without that, it might not have made as big of an impact as it did. I think we really can't understand the impact of the pill unless we put it in the context of the importance of the women's movement as a means of creating new opportunities for women that then the pill could help facilitate.
In a piece you wrote, I think on the 50th anniversary of the approval of the birth control pill, you say that one issue we didn't necessarily resolve for women in particular was the ability to balance parenthood and work. Could you talk about that and where we stand on that now?
We're still having problems with that. Women are still responsible overwhelmingly both their jobs and major responsibilities for care of children and the home. And it didn't equalize work opportunities or compensation for women. Women continue to be paid lower than men, and continue to have opportunities in the workforce that are limited by their gender. So we still have a ways to go before we will have complete equality between men and women in a whole variety of ways, and the pill couldn't solve that.
Elaine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Elaine Tyler May. She teaches American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of the book America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. We looked back at the impact of the birth control pill approved 60 years ago this month. Coming up, Wisconsin Department of Administration Secretary Joel Brennan joins us to talk about a new program aimed at helping renters here in the state. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the USDA will start taking applications next week for $19 billion worth of farm support. We'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about who's eligible and whether it's enough to help the state's farming economy. First, Governor Tony Evers announced a new assistance program yesterday aimed at helping renters who have been impacted by the economic fallout tied to the COVID-19 outbreak. The announcement of the $25 million grant plan came as the state's moratorium on evictions came to an end. The Wisconsin Rental Assistance Program is funded through the federal CARES Act. Our next guest joins us to talk about the RAP program and its goals. Joel Brennan is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Administration. Secretary Brennan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be with you again.
Well, can you give us the basics of this Wisconsin Rental Assistance Program?
Sure. So the basics, you started to talk a little bit about that in the opening. This is through the Coronavirus Relief Fund. That's the most flexible funding that the governor and the state received via the CARES Act. And this is part of what the governor has announced this week of more than $1 billion worth of support from that. But this is specifically $25 million to help the more than 780,000 households that are renters in the state of Wisconsin. And so for those renters, as you mentioned, there's a moratorium that on evictions that elapses or that lapses on May 26th, so next week. And this is in order to keep people in their homes. It's for assistance for rent. It can be for security deposits. It's up to $1,000 a month for 3 months. And we'll be doing this in conjunction. The state will be doing it in conjunction with local community action agencies around the state. There are 16 of them. They cover virtually every county in the state. So this is one way for us to very directly and hopefully efficiently get money on the streets to help people who truly, through no fault of their own and only through the fault of the coronavirus and the economic problems over the last several months, have the potential of having the roof over their head taken away. So we're trying to do this as directly and as quickly as we possibly can to ensure that people and families still have a safe place to live for the coming months.
Can you spell out who exactly would be eligible to get this grant funding?
Sure. So these are households that are 80% of the county median income in their specific counties around the state, with a focus on those that are less than 60%. I think it's clear that of renters around the state, a good number of them, more than a quarter of them, spend a significant amount of their household income, more than a third, on just those basic needs of housing. And so that this is directed specifically at lower income earners and trying to make sure that we do this on very much of an emergency basis. And so practically what this will mean is there will be a short application that will be done through the community action agencies. They will have the resources in hand. The state will provide those resources and allocate those resources to those community action agencies in the next few weeks. The applications, hopefully as much as possible, can be done online, and they will be certified there, and then immediately those checks will be cut. And the checks won't be cut to the individuals. They'll be cut to landlords, so to ensure that the money goes directly to keeping people in their homes and keeping them safe.
This is a fine point, but it could be important if there's somebody who's lost their job, say, because of a shutdown during COVID-19. Is that income requirement based on their 2019 income when they had a job, or can they point out, hey, I'm out of a job as of the last 2 months, and then be eligible?
Right. This will allow them. In fact, they're, as part of the application process, they have to they'll show evidence that through the COVID-19 crisis, either their most recent month or in the last few months, that their income has been affected by the public health crisis here. So this is in direct response, and people who have had, as you know, there have been almost 540,000 people who knew applicants for unemployment between like the middle of March and the middle of May. So there is no shortage of people across the state who have been affected. All of us have been affected in some way, but whose incomes have been affected by this. And so anyone who can demonstrate that, they will be eligible for the relief that this program can give them. So as much as possible, and as with a number of the things that we're doing, we will learn along the way. We are doing everything possible we can to maximize the federal relief that we have and make sure that we get those federal resources. But beyond maximizing it, it's how do we efficiently and effectively get these into the hands of people where they can help immediately. So we probably will learn some things along the way, but part of the benefit of this is we are working with trusted partners who we have worked with on other programs, and the state already has, through our Department of Administration, already has partnerships with these agencies around the state. So there are ones who already are doing programs at the local level. They already have relationships oftentimes with renters and people who use other services of theirs. So we hope that this is an efficient way for us to effectively get this into people's hands and have it be as effective as possible as quickly as we can.
Talking to Joel Brennan, Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Administration, looking at a program aimed at helping renters in the state with grants to pay directly to their landlords to get them through the COVID-19 economic damage. We've heard from some Republicans, including Senator Van Wongard, saying, well, hold on, why are you doing this program? You haven't even caught up on unemployment checks yet concerns about payments going out to people, not going out to people who've been waiting for a while. Can you talk about that side of the equation, those unemployment payments?
Sure. And, you know, if there's any individual who has filed for unemployment and we haven't been able to get money into their hands, that's a person who is hurting, and we need to do that as effectively as we possibly can. We have made significant investments both on the infrastructure side. Unfortunately, when it comes to unemployment insurance, it's one of the least updated and the worst in terms of the infrastructure. It's in some ways a 50-year-old system and still using very old technology. And so we've had to make some adjustments on the fly for that. We have also moved significant numbers of people over to be working on all the unemployment insurance claims. We have engaged call centers in this. So we are doing everything we possibly can. But the fact that there are still people out there who have not received their unemployment benefits is something that keeps us up at night, and we have to be working on every day. So we agree with anybody in the legislature and all those in the legislature who want us to move as quickly as we possibly can. So we are doing that. But even as we do that, and each day we're working on that, we need to make sure that people are doing things like keeping a roof over their heads. And so this is one way where we can use effectively the relationships that we already have, resources that are here that have already been allocated to us from the federal government, and getting those on the streets and into communities around the state as quickly as we possibly can. You know, there are places around the state, as you're aware and as your listeners are aware, that are reopening. And so some people may be seeing some light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to their own personal economic well-being. There are the federal government has increased unemployment benefits by $600 a week up until the end of July. And all those things are going to be things that I think are going to help people with their most immediate needs, especially housing for themselves and their families. But there are also going to be ways in which the state needs to continue that help. One thing I'd say to Senator Wongard and to all of the people in the legislature is we are doing everything possible to maximize the resources we have from the federal government. But I think there's also a clear, it's been clearly demonstrated that that's not going to be enough. So I'm hoping that no matter where people are on the ideological scale, that we can come together and work toward additional resources that can come to state, local, tribal governments for all the lost revenue over the last few months, because otherwise, and we're dealing with this already at the state level, but the financial and the fiscal issues that are going to be of concern there will only compound in the months to come. So I'm hoping that that some of that energy that the legislature has can be directed toward how do we ensure that we continue to get resources from the federal government to make things, to soften the blow at the state level, but also in our local partners, because there is nobody who has avoided any of the challenges and the problems that have come through COVID-19.
With the rental assistance program, if somebody's listening and thinking, hey, this is me, I'm in that income category, having trouble meeting my rent, I think I'm eligible, how and when can they apply?
Yeah, so we are right now, in the next several days, we're going to be finalizing contracts with the community action agencies. WISCAP, the Wisconsin Community Action Program, has information on their website. On the Department of Administration website, through the Division of Energy, Housing, and Community Resources, I would say that it will probably take us the next week to 10 days to stand all that up and ensure that the contracts are let and make sure that we can get all the application processes ready to go. But when that happens, then people will be able to go right there and be able to do those applications. And I hope we're going to be able to make sure that we get those resources out quickly. Again, one of the benefits of this, or where we are now, is the federal government, through the CARES Act and through the Coronavirus Relief Fund, has already disbursed those monies to the state government. So we won't be waiting on the federal government for these, and we are going to make sure that this money goes out into communities as soon as possible and into these trusted partners. So people will be able to find out more on those websites, and they will be working with their local media, with their local partners, to try to communicate this as much as they can in the next several days as we lead up to people actually being able to apply and then get these resources in their hands.
Secretary Brennan, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thanks a lot. Thanks for all the work that you're doing at a really important time. I truly appreciate it.
Thanks. That's Joel Brennan, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Administration. He joined us today to talk about Governor Tony Evers' $25 million assistance plan for renters in the state, funded by the Federal CARES Act, aimed at helping renters deal with the economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic. It's a holiday weekend coming up, and a lot of people will get the grills out. And tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll get some great advice with the return of Meathead. Meathead Goldwyn joins us again on Food Friday tomorrow. And to get ready, we want to hear your great advice for grilling. Just about everyone who grills, I think, has at least one magical secret technique or ingredient. Usually it's the exact opposite of someone else's magical grilling secret. So what is yours? Email us now at ideas@WPR.org, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think Meathead's going to talk mostly about meat, but we want to hear any of your grilling ideas. Veggies are just fine, too. And brats, definitely share your brat advice. Do you boil first? Do you use direct or indirect heat? Beer? Onions? Everybody who grills brats does it, I think, slightly differently. Corn on the cob? Well, one of my miracle discoveries was soaking the corn on the cob first and then leaving one layer of the husk on. Otherwise, it gets all too dried out. Maybe you want to argue with me. Do you have a way of making potato packs, veggie skewers? Uh-oh, charcoal and gas? Don't want to get too controversial here. Where do you stand on that? Share your grilling advice. Ideas@WPR.org is the email, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Looking ahead to Food Friday, this is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.